Hey, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for attending. One thing I want to start off with saying is this comes out of a longer dialogue among colleagues, and I think in this symposium, my impression is there's actually a fair bit of integration among the three talks. And one of the fun things about it is I'm going to push actually a few direct buttons in subsequent talks, so I hope we could create a generative dialogue. So my plan is to talk about some general thoughts that I have about bridging the cognitive science of religion to everyday Christian life. And I've attempted to kind of write a book on the culture and the cognitive science of religion that has recently come out with Rutledge. Trying to do just this, trying to kind of bridge genres between cultural psychology, faith, kind of some pragmatic philosophy of science and so forth. You see, whether scientific or Christian, there can be good or bad knowledge claims. And rich knowledge claims that speak to a range of persons. This was pretty important to early figures like William James and the pragmatist philosophy. James wrote about three criteria that constitute a rich knowledge claim in his work on radical empiricism. The first is fit with life. Knowledge claims are always inextricably bound to life because people don't ever use knowledge in a vacuum. There's no such thing as just knowing. There's knowing about, and knowledge is just not known in a vacuum. There is a human implication. So criteria for good knowledge is that it ought to fit with life. It ought to be sensible. So people use it in relation to other aspects of life. And there's a sense of satisfactory rest and peace, I quote, that comes from James, when a claim fits with lived experience. Another way in which we articulate what constitutes a truth claim is as a fit with the community. William James repeatedly argued that knowledge claims are not a matter of mere proclivities of one's subjectivity. He did so in a way that points out how one's knowledge is only true when it resonates with life outside one's own mind and resonates with others. So he made the claim that standards of fit are socio-normative in quality. The third criterion for what counts as truth is generativity. Fit with life and community is not static. And sometimes we need to change things in a community, or we need to change science, of course, when we think we know. Humans are always growing and changing in dynamic ways, and we change, the world around us changes in such a way that we can become, what we think we know can become antiquated or irrelevant. Rich knowledge claims, James argues, fit with the dynamics of life, and they do more. For a belief to remain true, it must generate something for us so we move forward. It makes future activities smoother, causes innovation, and so forth. It's through this radical empirical lens that I approach the challenge of linking the cognitive science of religion with Christian experience. And I'm going to start off with a couple of kind of presuppositions about cognitive science of religion, or CSR. Dennett, for example, in Breaking the Spell, he describes religion as being the accidental result of multiple cognitive devices. And devices refer to an automatic mechanism that operates inside the mind. One author calls it the cognitive skills are realized by production rules, where the production rules are if, then, or condition action plans. The if or condition part specifies a circumstance under which the rule will apply. The then or action part, the rule specifies what to do in that circumstances. The idea in CSR is that humans operate according to such computational principles or algorithms. So consider what this means. If you think about people like Gervais or Zan, they put out articles that say things like analytic thinking promotes disbelief. Right? And the idea is that there's a claim that religion is a byproduct of mechanisms that basically form a cognitive architecture. If we can be controlled and rational, we can override this in these intuitive mechanisms. So religion is something to be managed and overridden. So the implications of such ideas can be seen in well-known people like Richard Dawkins, for example, who of course is an easy target because he's just so thin. The general theory of religion is an accidental byproduct, a misfire of something useful is the one I wish to advocate. So I'm not so concerned about the byproduct as I am more about the issue of this notion of mental mechanisms being the core of what cognition is all about. See, where I may differ from my colleagues in that I don't see how CSR can actually grasp the experience of everyday life in the way in which we usually do CSR, which is usually good old-fashioned AI representational cognitive psychology. I don't see how that actually works in anyone's life. Some authors have explicitly stated they're not interested in what belief is about, for example, because it's not a relevant focus. Christian belief involves particular content and involves an integrational emotional entanglement with the world. So in approaching CSR in terms of abstract mechanisms bypasses this content and sentimental entanglement, which means to lose what it means to have the experience of belief. So consider fit with life. One key to getting at religious belief is to take seriously the role of culture, which often constitutes the aboutness and the content of belief. CSR has yet to develop an account of culturally shaped religious belief because of its approach is unconcerned with culturally specific content. Consider fit with the community. Claims about cognitive mechanisms in CSR work really well for cognitive scientists, but I'm not sure if they work really well for anyone outside cognitive science. And I'm not sure if it speaks to a community beyond its own. In reference to generativity, CSR researchers have been moving forward together insofar as their work has generated a lot of ideas in the cognitive science of religion community. Unfortunately, there are times when religious believers and researchers have come to a place where things just aren't working, they don't get along, and they feel, well, let's just live with it and go our separate ways. So the problem is I'm not convinced that CSR has been entirely generative for religious believers. So I think that a better approach to belief is something other than an abstract, ethereal thing that's emergent in decontextualized mental programs. I think it works better to treat religious belief as and related cognition as culturally situated activity instead of entities. So belief is a kind of lived action, not a propositional storage bit of information. So cognition can be thought of as always drawn back into the world through the world way which the world constitutes our cognition. That is, the function of belief is knowing about something and somebody who one engages with. So one cannot consider belief per se, because there's no belief without a sense of what one's believing about. And this aboutness really pushes, I think, this discussion into a cultural realm. The thing that our beliefs are about are always led to the world and others, and that is every religious belief is related to something else. And it simply doesn't make sense to talk about a belief that stands as a subjective isomorphic thing. You may think it's in your head, but more likely it's entwined with the world. Eventually, something that can be misconceived in terms of self-contained subjectivity is actually something that's necessarily in relation to the world inside and outside our heads. And James also pointed out that belief is also inherently experiential, by which he meant that religious belief is experienced in our bodies by way of physiology and emotion or sentimentalities. In the course of living with others, our belief is formed in an embodied way. The entire way in which reality shows up is shaped in our beliefs formed through relations with others, in our corporately entwined inter-embodiment. Religious belief is an experience that we bodily feel in the real world. So what this approach does is take us away from general cognitive covering laws, right, or the mechanisms. It revamps the way cognitive science is usually done. It erodes kind of post-positivist modes of realism. It also is an approach that takes culture and the role of culture in human cognition really, really seriously. It erodes, several types of realism. So in reference to believers, of course, this also raises some problems, because my supposition is that people want to know if the absolute exists. It comes up often. I mean, when I first started publishing in this area, the very first email I got in response to an article was, well, do you believe in God or not? Are you a real Christian or not? Which was, okay, I don't know. It's a conversation whether or not God is real, and what does the foregoing tell us about ontology or metaphysics? What I want to discuss is that when religious belief becomes technical dogma or certain knowledge, I think it actually also is deeply problematic. It bypasses authentic belief. And challenging realism of certain sorts is a good thing for us to have authentic faith. So a corresponding parallel conversation tends to emerge when you deal with researchers engaging in CSR. While the notion of an absolute God is not an issue for most researchers in CSR, there is, however, a faith in science that is the vehicle of truth. There's a, I'll be polemic and push it and say there's a quasi-religious commitment to scientific method that being critiqued as being referred to as methodolatry. As we take method and idolatry, collide them, we get methodolatry. I want to discuss how unwillingness to fall into methodology is, in fact, a stronger position for researchers as well. So the implication of my approach, I think, is a little bit difficult, maybe, in both religious approaches and in the approach of cognitive science of religion, is that I'm talking about a plurality of worlds of experience. I'm not talking about a singular world that we can find statements of that have meaning by virtue of what it refers to. That is, to use the parlance from an earlier talk, I'm not convinced about a mind-independent world, and it may be with multiple worlds of experience. There may be a religious world and a world of science as established by cognitive scientists. Radical empiricism is to look at such realities and understand the lived worlds of others. The challenge for researchers is to recognize that there may be other worlds that do not share the same taken-for-granted realities, and such other worlds are not easily bypassed. So research, wherein we take the presence of multiple worlds seriously, has a different set of presuppositions. There are ambiguities inherent in the study of multiple worlds, and radical empiricism involves recognizing that work often includes ambiguities and contradictions. So that is, this vision for research eschews kind of the certainty that methodology often gives psychologists. Radical empiricism means that we have to think in fuzzier categories and in ambiguous spaces of uncertainty. And James argues that the vice of humans is that they slide into a concern for seeking definitive answers that miss the, quote, intermediate shades that populate life. Such an approach stands in contrast to research that seeks to close things down through obsession with certainty and method. So it is for this reason that James suggests that radical empiricism stands for the legitimacy of the notion of the some. I know something. That is, we do not need definitive or complete knowledge, we just need to know something. So I think this opens up a helpful discussion. The foregoing discussion doesn't compel a researcher or believer to take a firm ontological stance on something like the existence of God, but it doesn't cut off the possibility in discussion about God as being part of the research. We don't lose context. It can be part of research when others who have studied live a world where it's a meaningful part of the world. I think the danger is that this could seem to undermine religious believers, but faithfulness to religious practice in everyday life, I suspect, is far less bound up in ontological certainties than we even dare admit to ourselves. Giovanni Vattimo, the theologian, has kind of heavily influenced me here. He elaborates on such notions by arguing that uncertainty is important for faith. This claim is grounded in how such ontological claims are rooted in what he called a truth totality. A truth totality is sure and certain knowledge about whatever subject matter is at stake. One who takes a position of truth totality is one who takes one's knowledge to be complete and certain about a given domain. This kind of MO will be marked by a religious practitioner who claims to know everything about the character or quality of God, or appeals to universal systems of values that spell out orthodox behavior. So whether religious or scientific, the problem of true totality is that it can impede human freedom, and therein lies the violence of it. When one begins to become dogmatically certain, this is when one shuts down authentic dialogue of all sorts, whether with God or others, and we dehumanize others as well. True totalities mean that personhood is dictated to religious believers as what one sees as experience undermined in favor of dogma specified by the true totality. It precludes authentic relationships with God or anyone else. So science and religion run the same risk when they buttress certainty. So we can lose sight of the way in which certain religious or scientific perspectives run the risk of committing violence. So Vattimo is famous. Maybe you've never heard of Vattimo, just believe me, he's famous for this. And he talks about the idea called the weakening of truth. and it amounts to the demise of the appeal to uncertain truth claims that methodology or dogma perpetuate. That is, truth faces, this is his quote, a challenge in the world of postmodern pluralism, the challenge of coming to grips with the fact that consensus on individual questions is above all a problem of collective interpretation, of constructing paradigms shared, or at any rate, explicitly recognized. In reference to religious belief, culture and linguistic practices result in the constitution of experienced realities. Religious believers cannot deny this inherent pluralism, which, of course, keeps raising its head in our global society. An allegiance with unassailable religious metaphysics is untenable as an allegiance with scientific methodology. So the demise of the truth totality, I think, is really good. We need to be thankful for it, because it enables a fuller expression of both faith and a fuller expression of science. The weakening softens the possibility of violence. Secularism involves the end of unassailable truth totalities, I think, has paradoxically enabled a return to the sacred, because it pushes us back to encountering God in a personal realm instead of encountering God through pre-given, presupposed dogma. It also enables scientists to engage others in their own right, especially as an issue in the social science. We can imagine engaging indigenous populations or religious believers. Weakening of truth totality and the suspension of presupposed ideas in a pluralistic world means that we can approach our subject matter and see people in their own right instead of defining a priori who and what they are. So it involves, scientists, for example, can see people in their own right instead of condescending with presupposed truths that actually alienate their work from religious believers. It makes scientists accountable to people other than themselves, which is okay. So a challenge is that a pluralistic world outlined by James and Vattel could seem to put us in a place where, like, oh no, we're in an anything goes situation. Suddenly we have laissez-faire relativism. I don't think it's the case. Rethinking relativism along the lines of what I'm talking about involves turning to the notion of kenosis. And this, again, comes from Vattel. And this notion comes from this notion where Christ is reported to have humbled himself to be a human and die on the cross. I'm referring to Philippians here. It's kenosis. The humbling and the emptying is kenosis. It is about surrendering one's own perspective enough to be like another and understand another. Kenosis entails suspending temptation to act out of truth totality. And it removes blinders that can hinder people from understanding others. It's about genuine love and emptying oneself. This is not a self-annihilation, and I'll say in a moment, it's also not a convictionless life. The notion of kenosis in the Christian tradition actually gives space to pluralism. And I do find that pluralism is far more Christian than non-pluralist approaches on the basis of this notion of kenosis and emptying for the other. The approach radically changes how we think about relativism because it enables dialogue first and foremost. A divine holy other is possible in light of the weakening of truth because authentic relationality is enabled and dialogue is enabled. Misplaced faith and dogma disables us from listening. Religious belief can only have meaning when characterized by deep uncertainty of opinion, because only then we have the kind of liberty where we suspend our own presuppositions to engage God, for example. It's a good for scientists also because it enables a kind of openness to discovery and creativity. Another basis for presenting us to fall into anything goes situation is that the weakening of truth doesn't necessarily necessitate a kind of relativism demarcated by laissez-faire relativism. Just because people think and know and experience about God or claims of science may not be absolutely certain, it doesn't mean we lose conviction. And it doesn't mean that we suddenly can do whatever we want. It's important to be clear that we're talking about participation in communities that constitute what seems as real. So we're dealing with a class of things that must be not dealing with a class of things that must be discovered. Rather, we're talking about the ways that people jointly constitute what is real in a deeply experiential way. So it means that experience is not separable and not reducible to a single individual, right? So we don't have objective reality, but we don't have anything goes frequently in discourses either. And that's the important point to realize, that people are accountable to wider social cultural realities. We don't collapse into subjective proclivities, like kind of the critics of pragmatism would say. So we often live our religious or scientific worlds of experience as second nature. Our own take it for granted, understandings sink into obscure, tacit behavior because we naturally act without a second thought. When we understand another, we see her from a perspective that is outside our own. And we simultaneously come to see her from within the reality she lives with others. Conversely, we can see our own taken-for-granted realities in the same process. So rather than testing truths against truth-totalizing facts, we test them against different realities. And a principle that guides such endeavors is not the search for propositions conformable with non-linguistic or non-cultural facts. It's the principle of charity that is no longer dependent on truth totality's rule for action. Knowledge claims become relational phenomena founded in friendship. And instead of objecting, of objectifying moral order, we can turn to care for the other, and this in turn mounts to a dynamic activity in negotiating friendship. So James's approach to plural worlds may open up the challenge to many cognitive scientists, because it challenges their science. It exposes it as one worldview around many, among many. This move is not so bad, because I think we can end up with a more dynamic CSR that can account for people's experience and the content of their belief. I think relativism exposed by pragmatics that I'm talking about with pragmatism is also really good for believers. Far from being a liability, it enables us to turn back to things like kenosis and charity and be more Christian in our research. So, thanks for letting me share.
We did go a little bit over time, and we started late, and then you went a little over time. So 8 minutes for questions, seven and a half, actually.
So please worry about me. Richard.
So I guess you've probably heard this before, but it just seems from my realist perspective, but when you say truth, you really mean justification or rational belief or something like that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just plurality of viewpoints doesn't in any way suggest that there's no truth, as I would say. It just means that it may be difficult to justify our beliefs, and someone will always disagree.
Yeah.
Like people maybe disagreed on the structure of the heavens in the 1500s, right? But it doesn't mean that there was no truth of the matter. So this truth totality is something more like dogmatism.
Yeah.
And you know, we're all fallibilists, we're all skeptics, so I totally agree with that, but the language is misleading.
Okay, here's what you're saying. And maybe I'm trying to provoke that sentiment a bit.
Right.
Because in the discipline of psychology where I come from, there is a massive overstatement of claims, massive too much faith in what we think we know in a discipline that has no object of measurement.
There's a tendency towards dogmatism.
Is that?
You mean there's a tendency towards dogmatism?
Absolutely, yeah. And I remember I've been in meetings where I've talked to stuff with cognitive scientists, and I get the same type of emotional, psycho-emotional pushback.
Yeah.
When I say, well, I don't think actually method reveals anything. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, it's like I drop an ideological grenade into the room. It's the same one when I see a Christian believer. You know what? Maybe salvation, praying to sinner's prayer, actually isn't an issue of salvation. It's the same sort of kind of dogma pushback. And the issue that I'm seeing, you have a follow-up question?
No.
Okay. So the issue that I'm seeing is that psychology and religious believers aren't talking too well to each other, but they also have the same problem in terms of talking with others. Mm-hmm. And where I'm trying to push this is towards a pragmatic approach to science, which gives us more space to engage the other.
I guess I feel that skepticism or an absence of dogmatism is what we need there, not this sort of what I see as sort of a confused disavowal of truth, reality, and so on.
Well, yeah, I've redefined truth to be something more like solidarity.
Right, that's yeah. Empty, oh my goodness.
Yes, exactly.
But then it just muddies the water.
Or makes it more true. Go ahead.
Your approach strikes me as very similar to Gadamer's philosophical hermeneutics.
Yeah.
And I know that later in his life, Gadamer really looked to the transcendent without defining it explicitly as a kind of interreligious point of contact. I think it's really interesting to see you cover this from a cognitive science perspective. I do it strict theology, so it's great.
Okay.
I just wonder how could you see an interreligious dialogue, how would that work concretely from a cognitive standpoint?
Yeah, so one thing that I didn't get time to talk about today is I spent several chapters in my book redefining what counts as cognition.
Good.
Right, so instead of having representational cognition, good old-fashioned AI, I talk about inactivism and connectionism as a model of cognition, which is where our mind is entwined with others in the world. Right? And that's kind of a foundational theory that's more compatible with this. So I would take a non-representational approach to cognition. And I think, by the way, Gadamer was Gadamer's student.
Right.
Yeah. So of course, you're going to hear echoes of fusions of horizon and rows of memory as well in the background. So, in terms of how we do cognition, I think what we need to do is just let go of representations and dive away and let's move on. Go ahead.
Can you relate what you've been saying? I'm married, as you know, to a Korean lady, and
yeah.
So I have this Eastern Western thing going on,
yeah.
And it seems like, and I'm learning a lot about kind of a holistic approach to truth claims, as opposed to kind of a linear style that I've grown up with in the Western world,
mm-hmm.
And. Everything you've been saying sort of, I think, presupposes that we're all in this Western mindset.
Mm-hmm.
But does an Eastern more holistic sort of ability to hold truth and tension more easily, does that play into your thinking there as well?
Yeah, initially it did, actually, because the way in which I came to this was actually doing intercultural work on immigration adjustment and biculturality.
Yeah.
And my initial work was all in kind of immigration identity. And there's several writers in the early 90s that were open to different holistic modes of thought than went back to visit people like William James, Charles Fierce, so on and so forth. And it was the quote Eastern thought was kind of a catalyst for opening some of these ideas. And then, of course, the problem then is what constitutes Eastern thought? I'm not comfortable saying that Korea is the same as China, the same as Japan, which, of course, we do in the literature. We have the West versus the rest.
Right.
So we get it's very messy. But there is kind of an implicit link here. And it kind of kicked off in the early 90s of return to some earlier things. Terry?
Two questions together.
Okay.
Do you recommend that the reader or the audience here read William James' book on religion?
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, in terms of his outlook or approach to the subject matter, do you consider him to be a psychologist or a philosopher?
Okay, second one, I don't know. James, I mean, he's slippery at best sometimes.
Yes.
So, I would highly recommend people read Charles Peirce's Then Jews, James always refers to Charles Peirce's inspiration. And I think the best entry is actually probably James' book on pragmatism before you go to Varieties. Because Varieties and later work, Varieties of
Spirits,
it has it's lots going on there that presupposes what's going on in pragmatism.
Yeah.
One more question.
Well, I work with James, so I can ask.
I think you're reading Myra. It's 2012.
So sometimes when people talk about different accounts of truth, I think, so I guess my question is, like, if you're thinking about a pragmatic set of criteria for truth along the lines that you describe,
mm-hmm.
I mean, we can talk about pragmatic truth, right, as, you know, attaining these conditions, but that's also consistent with another use of the word true in a more kind of correspondence sense, such that, you know, one particular kind of mental event can be both true in a pragmatic sense, but that doesn't preclude it from being true in a correspondence sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, as one of your comment about when it comes to rival accounts of truth, they're not necessarily rivals if it's possible for a particular belief or mental event to be true in multiple senses at the same time. What do you think about that?
Yeah, actually, it's a really good point. I made a joke about Rorty a moment ago, because Rorty's the one that really tackles this,
yeah,
this attack on correspondence of theories of truth.
Yeah.
So I'm just kind of wading into that. My hunch is that the literature's probably been too simplistic in dismissing correspondence theories.
It just seems like a lot of the heat is a kind of a peeing contest about who gets to use the word T-R-U-E.
Yes.
But it's just that, you know, it's not inconsistent for some belief to be true in multiple senses at the same time. There's no contradiction.
Yeah, it's a good point. Let's keep going.
Yeah, Nathan. Thanks very much again.